sweetness down in my soul. I could stand some loving, oh so bad. I feel so funny, I feel so sad. I want a little steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I need some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl. You've been acting different, I've been told. Soothe me, I want some sugar in my bowl. I want some steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl.
And this is WBAI New York 99.5 FM, Sugar in My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones, and our guest of the evening is Christian McBride. We had a lovely conversation before he had to run for a gig at Village Vanguard at that time. But we'll hear all about that later. Let's just get started now because there's so much to cover.
I'll take with me the warmth of thee, a taste of honey, a taste much sweeter than wine. I'll leave behind my heart to wear, and may it ever remind you of a taste of honey. She died dreaming of his kiss. His kiss was honey, a taste much sweeter than wine. And I will return. Leave behind my heart to wear, and may it ever remind you of the taste of honey, a taste much sweeter than wine. But he never came back for his love so fair, and so she died dreaming of his kiss. His kiss was honey, a taste much sweeter than wine.
This is Joyce Jones, and I'm here with...
My name is Mongo Slade. And me and my boys are from New York City, and we want to place a bet. What movie is that from?
Oh, my gosh. You expect me to tell you?
Well, why don't you take it to one of the local bookies? Well, when you go to the local bookies, ain't nothing going to take your bet until you say it's okay. So I figured we'd just come see you. How much you want to bet? Well, who are these people here? These are my partners. Bubble Top Woodson, Fish and Chips Freddy, Jody Tibbs. How much you want to bet? Is it
no,
Rita Vell?
No. What's that?
Let's do it again.
Oh, my gosh. I obviously need to see it again really soon. Oh, my gosh.
Bill Cosby with his pink suit on.
And a sort of round the head
right, with
Ray
the
bands.
Right. I think that's a must see. Particularly Uptown Saturday Night and Let's Do It Again. They should be on the AFI top 400 list.
Ah.
Those are American classics.
Well, you'll have to introduce yourself, though.
Oh, sorry. My name really is Christian McBride.
Hello, Christian McBride.
How are you, Joyce Jones?
Good. Welcome to Sugar My Bowl.
Great to be back.
Yeah, exactly, for the second time, because the last time you were here was for an Abby Lincoln special.
That's right.
And thank you for visiting us at
well,
that
I've
time.
Been a fan of yours for a long time since we unofficially met on Freddie Hubbard's last interview.
Oh, that's right, Freddie Hubbard, yeah. Yes, that's right. You were at Freddie's...
At his house, that's right.
Yes.
It was so hilarious watching him watch the game, talking to you at the same time.
And then he would ask you questions.
Right.
Did your team win?
That night?
Yeah.
And he was watching the Lakers. I could care less about the Lakers. I can't stand the Lakers.
Okay.
Sorry. I love Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and I love Magic Johnson.
Right.
But the Lakers,
So, Christian.
Yeah.
By the time this airs, people will have missed you at the Village Vanguard.
Right.
You will have been there.
Yeah.
For, what, a week?
Almost. We will have played only through Saturday instead of Sunday.
Okay.
I have a pretty important gig in Washington, D.C. coming up. As you know, Sonny Rollins is one of the Kennedy Center honorees this year.
Yes, yes.
And I've been very honored to have been asked to come in by CBS and produce and direct his portion of the telecast.
Wow.
Actually, because it hasn't aired yet, I can't tell you who's going to be on there.
Okay. Well, I would like to know,
it's going to be
have you ever done this before?
This is my first behind-the-scenes, like, television production gig.
How did you get the opportunity to produce something for television?
I did the Kennedy Center Honors a couple of years back when Dave Brubeck was an honoree.
Okay.
And the gentleman who is the overall musical director for the Kennedy Center Honors, his name is Rob Mathis.
Okay.
And I've worked with Rob on and off on some different pop gigs. Mm. And most recently, we worked together with Sting. And so Rob says, hey, you know, I know you know so much about Sonny Rollins. You worked with him a lot. And would you be interested in coming in and doing this? And I went, what? Sure.
Wow. That's great. Also to back up. See, now we're going to be all over the place because
you
just
be all over the place.
Cause
that'll make people pay attention when
that's
they
right.
listen to us.
That's right. Because you've done radio.
Yes.
from what Dee Dee Bridgewater says. You have filled in for her.
Only on occasion.
Yeah.
Yeah, we actually, Dee Dee and I, it's amazing because we seem to have been doing a lot of the same things in the same places a lot recently. We've, like, there were a couple of times where I sat in for her on Jazz Set on her show, and vice versa. I sat in for Mary McPartland a couple of times.
Yes, piano
and
jazz.
Exactly. And then when I couldn't do it, I recommended Dee Dee.
Oh, okay.
And Dee Dee is also on my new duet CD, Conversations with Christian.
Yes, indeed. I like, oh my gosh. I'm glad you mentioned that because I really, really enjoy your rendition of It's Your Thing.
Yeah.
One more time, baby.
Get down.
Ow. I felt that one.
Hit me.
Oh, Lord. It's your thing. Do what you want to do. I can't tell you who to sock it to. Because it's your thing. Do what you want to do now. I can't tell you. It's my thing. Oh, don't pull on that string like that. Oh. It's your thing.
Take me there, baby.
Do what you wanna do. Oh, it's your thing.
I'm actually not surprised that that has become, you know, for lack of a better term, the hit off of the CD.
Oh, okay.
Because it's so much fun, you know. Dee Dee in there start. We just got in there and started clowning, you know.
Well, when I saw you the Blue Note, I got a taste of that.
Oh, clowning. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. We clowned at the Blue Note, and then we're going on tour again together in 2013 with the Monterey Jazz Festival All-Stars.
Okay.
So Dee Dee and I, you know, we just arm in arm these days. My Gemini sister.
Okay. Yeah, I like that one a lot.
Thank you.
So, yeah, we were talking about you doing radio.
Mm-hmm.
And now doing a television production. Have you had any sort of training for broadcasting at all?
No. Hmm. No. Let me take that back. My uncle, who passed away a few years ago, he worked for WHAT Radio in Philly.
Yeah.
And so I grew up around my uncle and all around the great legendary DJs in Philly, you know, like Georgie Woods and Jimmy Bishop and Butterball Tamburo and Jocko Henderson, all these cats. So although I was never formally trained, I got to be around those guys all the time. So once I got older and moved to New York, the common phrase was, you know, you got a good radio voice.
You do. As a matter of fact, that's how I found out that you subbed for Dee Dee.
Right.
Because I said, you have a great radio voice and you should sub for her. She's like, well, he already subs for me.
she put me on to her show a couple of years back, and I really enjoyed doing it. And then I started doing my own show on Sirius XM about a year and a half ago.
Oh, okay.
And I'm desperately trying to find some time to get my second season started.
Wow.
But, you know, I have to book around my touring schedule, so
sure.
I've been pretty busy this year, thank goodness.
Yes. Well, you're always busy.
Well, I'm also always busy trying to stay busy.
Okay.
So now that I have a nice chunk of time at home between now and March, I'm going to get a lot of stuff done around town.
Okay.
I can't wait. So glad to be home.
Well, one of the things you do around town is the Jazz Museum of Harlem.
Yes.
What is your participation in that, and how did you wind up participating?
Lauren Schoenberg, the executive director.
Who's actually on your big band recording.
That's correct. right on. You bad, baby. You bad. I first met Lauren when I, pretty much right after I moved to New York, he was directing the American Jazz Orchestra, Cooper Union, which was originally started by John Lewis.
Okay.
And he called me out
John
of the
Lewis
blue.
Of the MJQ.
Of MJQ, yes.
Okay.
And Lauren called me out of the blue. I knew who he was because, you know, I knew he was a saxophone player, worked with Benny Goodman, and was known as this great educator and historian. So he called me and asked if I would do this gig with the AJO. And that's how we first officially met. I must have been 18 at that time. So throughout the years, we just kind of kept loose touch. And when I became the artistic director of Jazz Aspen's summer program out in Colorado, I did that for 2 years. And the staff in Jazz Aspen said, well, we want to bring in an educational director. Who would you recommend? So Lauren's name came up, and I said, I think he'd be great. And he came out and joined the Jazz Aspen staff. That was in 2002, I believe, 2001, 2002, something like that. And after working with him every summer, about 2004, he told me all this background about the Jazz Museum, and he said, you know, we're still in the early stages, and I would really love if you would come on board as my co-pilot, my co-director. So I'd be honored. So we've been working together officially since the beginning of 2005
with
the National Jazz Museum. And, of course, through Lauren and the Jazz Museum, I got to be really good friends with our buddy, Greg Thomas.
Greg Thomas, yes. Greg Thomas, who used to be on WBAI, Keep Swinging. We miss Greg here.
Yeah, we miss GT. He's up north now.
Where is he up north?
New Rochelle.
Is he?
Yeah.
Oh, sweat. Even though he left. But see, he's still writing in the New York newspaper.
Yes,
so I
absolutely.
Just think he's right here.
Yeah. Yeah, he still is. He still is. He's a stone's throw away.
Yes.
I really love working with everyone up in the Harlem community. Many of whom, particularly the musicians, I knew already.
Mm-hmm.
But now in my official capacity, I had a reason to be in Harlem often when I was off the road. As a matter of fact, this month I'll be conducting all of the Tuesday evening program. You can come this coming Tuesday to the National Jazz Museum of Harlem. That will be the 13th. And my month-long series will be on jazz cities.
Well,
so
yes.
1 week I'm going to do the music of Pittsburgh, the music of Chicago, the music of Detroit, and then I'll end the year with the music of Philly.
Well, that actually reminded me of the recording that you did with Questlove and Uri Kane.
Go ahead.
So... that when I saw that, and I understood that there were different recordings. There was a Detroit experiment.
Yes. And they did a Harlem experiment also.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I didn't hear those two, but I did hear the Philadelphia experiment.
Well, that was the flagship one. That's the one that got it all started.
Right. How did that wind up happening?
I got a call from a guy named Aaron Levinson, who we went to the same high school in Philly a few years apart. He says, Christian, I don't know if you remember me. We were the Kappa together, so we started talking. All the names started getting familiar. And he says, I'm working for Andy Hurwitz at Rope-A-Dope Records. And, you know, we just had this wild idea. You know, I don't know what you think, or I don't even know if you're available. We want to get you and Questlove back together because we know you guys grew up together. And Uri Kane, and just kind of do, like, you know, whatever.
Now, how did Uri Kane get in the picture?
Philadelphian. And I know that... as you know, inside the jazz world, he's been very respected for having this very, you know, eclectic sense of, you know, he's a monster player, but he's also very well-trained and well-studied classical musician.
Mm-hmm. And he plays keys.
Yeah.
And synth. And
exactly. And he's also played a lot of avant-garde music, mm-hmm. and he's also played a lot of straight ahead and a lot of R&B. So to get these different parts together would make, at the very least, an interesting sonic recipe.
Yeah, actually, my favorite is the hidden track.
Ah!
I was like,
sweet.
I was listening to it, and I'm like, okay, which one is that?
Right.
Because it's not on the case, it's not on anything,
right.
But I had to look it up.
Thank you.
I wish I could have that back because I don't know how we wound up doing that. I mean, the session was so loose because I remember Quest was actually recording with someone else at the same time in the other studio down the hall.
Oh, wow.
So we would do take one, and he'd be like, hey, I'll be right back.
Oh, no.
He'd run down the hall, be gone for about a half an hour, come back, and then we'd do take two. So it was just like a mishmash of all kinds of stuff going on in the studio. And then somehow just the two of us came up.
That's it.
Yeah, and I thought, I got an idea. So I told the engineer, I said, just roll the tape and, you know, just roll with me.
Mm.
I think I know what I'm doing. I'm not quite sure yet, but just go with me. So I wound up overdubbing all of these different bass parts. Mm-hmm. And the bass drum you hear is actually my Timberlands hitting the carpet.
Oh, my goodness.
So I just told him to mic my foot,
right,
you know,
right.
Mic the floor,
right,
and, you know, put some boost in. So, yeah, that was my own little one-man band thing.
That was excellent. I really enjoyed that one a lot.
Thank you.
So do you think that it'll be revisited, or will you,
We've
do you plan to do something?
We've been trying for 11 years to do the Philadelphia Experiment Part 2, and I keep telling Amir, I said, man, we better do this quick while people still care.
Yeah, right.
Because pretty soon, all of the fans from the original Philadelphia Experiment, they're going to be moving on to something else. They're going to be like, man, we don't care if they do it, Part 2. So I said, let's hurry up, man. I know he's doing Jimmy Fallon and all, but
let's
knock this baby out.
So... You and Questlove.
Yes.
How did you meet?
Oh, man. It was like meeting my long-lost brother. You know how it is in high school. There's always these cliques, you know, millions of worlds inside this one building, you know. So my world was always extremely small because I was, you know, listening to jazz and old-school R&B. Everybody was listening to rap and popular music. But me and Joey DeFrancesco, my other best friend from high school, we were hardcore listening to jazz all day long. So first day of school in 10th grade, we found out we had a new student coming in to the music department. And, you know, I see this brother walk in, and he picks up the bass. He picks up the acoustic bass. I said, I thought you said this guy played drums. So he does play drums. I don't know what he's doing over on the bass. So he's playing the bass, and he's trying to play the bass line to Funky Good Time. And so right away, I said, this cat is playing James Brown. I love him already. I don't even know who he is, but I love him already. And he's trying to play the bass, so I said something like, so you like James Brown, huh? What you know about James Brown? He was like, no, what you know about James Brown? I said, I know a lot about James Brown. He said, me too. Right away, we were inseparable.
Wow.
And what was strange is that because Amir, he's another person who was like a walking encyclopedia about not jazz, but he knows about the history of R&B and soul unlike anybody I know. And part of that is because of his father. His father is Lee Andrews, the great doo-wop singer.
Oh, wow.
And we would sit up there and talk about all these obscure R&B records. And then once we would start talking about our R&B thing, Joey would kind of move back and say, okay, well, I'm going to let y'all have that conversation. You know? And then when me and Joey would start talking about jazz, Amir would kind of move back and say, I'm going to let y'all have that conversation. So I was always the middleman between the two of them. So I was bridging both worlds in high school. But I'm so proud to see what he's done with the Roots and how he kind of single-handedly put Philly soul back on the map in the mid-90s, discovering Jill Scott and Jaguar Wright and all these.
What came out of Black Lily.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So I'm proud of him.
Well, he seems to be, in my thinking, he's like the king of the rim shot these days.
You can say that again.
I mean, it's like, you know, because I'm used to, you know, Elvin Jones and, you know, Roy Haynes and, you know, Max Roach. And then I hear Questlove with the rim shot. You know, there was actually a moment in the Philadelphia Experiment where he seemed to be trying to find himself when you would do the sort of straight-ahead jazz thing.
Yeah. I keep telling him he needs to do it more often. He's like, man, I'm too shy, man. I said, dude, all you got to do is just be around the right cats and just do it more often.
Yeah.
You'll be just fine, man. I got another great high school story about us. We got in trouble. A whole lot. Actually, me, him, and Joey got in trouble. How's this for a high school rhythm section? Our jazz band's rhythm section was myself, Questlove, Kurt Rosenwinkel, and Joey DeFrancesco.
Okay.
And we had this big school production, something called Sentimental Journey. It was like our own, like, Broadway production.
Uh-huh.
And we're in the Pitt Orchestra, and part of the big overture, we had to play New York, New York.
Mm.
And our band director wanted us to play it, you know, pretty straight. He said, I really want this, you know, like the Frank Sinatra version. You know, guys, don't fool around. Just keep it straight. Don't put all that extra stuff in it like y'all like to do. So, you know, we're at rehearsal start spread. So, I don't know. We got together before the concert. He says, hey, once the concert starts, he can't stop it and scold us. So we agreed that when we got to New York, New York, he said, man, when we get there, let's funk it up. Mm-hmm. Joey said, yeah, I'm going to come in screaming on the organ.
Mm-hmm.
And Amir said, yeah, I'm going to put some backbeat on it. So the trumpets played this big fanfare. So start spreading. And then we came in like the, I don't know, like Bobby Boo Bland band or something like. And Kurt Rosenwinkel's playing all this chant guitar and scratch rhythm. Our band director's face got so red.
Yeah.
I mean, we thought he was going to have a stroke right here on the podium. And he's mouthing us. He's like, y'all going to be in trouble after this concert. But it was funky. Boy, it was funky.
So now that you, like, destroyed your bridge there, how did you wind up at Juilliard?
Well, through all of that, I was studying classical music. I had great classical teachers growing up in Philly. My main teacher, his name was Neil Courtney. He was the associate principal of the Philadelphia Orchestra. Annie Peterson, who played in the Philly Pops Orchestra. Margie Keefe, who was my very, very first teacher, who was mainly a cellist, but she taught bass lessons as well. They thought that I had progressed enough, even in my classical studies. They said, you know, you're going to get your jazz, you know, because, you know, you're playing with all these different guys around town, and you're listening to these records, and you're getting information firsthand from all these local great musicians. You should think about going to school for classical music. I said, sure, you know. I said, well, I know I ain't ready for Juilliard. You know, they were like, well, you should try it just to see what happens. Because I've been playing in the Philadelphia Youth Orchestra, Temple University Youth Chamber Ensemble.
Wow.
And that's not much music for bass and chamber music. Mm-hmm. So I was playing a lot of cello parts.
Okay.
And so they said, we think you're good enough. You should try it out and just go for it and see what happens. So I came up here to audition for Juilliard, really not thinking that I was going to get in.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted the experience of being at Juilliard playing classical music. Mm-hmm. You know, with
European
the,
classical.
With the, yeah, European classical music with mm-hmm. with the best in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And classic scenario, I'm sitting out in front of the door, which in retrospect was kind of cruel. You could hear all of the other auditioners while they were playing.
Yeah.
And guys in there playing Koussevitzky and Dragonetti and just all over the bass. Perfect intonation and perfect technique. And I'm just sitting out there like, oh, God. Maybe they'll let me walk a blues or something like that. Because my chops aren't like that.
Uh-huh.
And I went in for my audition and I played my little piece. I don't even remember what it was. But the other thing that freaked me out was my accompanist was sight reading.
Oh.
The music.
Oh, my.
And I had never seen anybody perfect. I don't think I've seen anyone do it till this day. Perfectly sight read music.
Oh, wow.
So I'm nervous enough playing for these judges at Juilliard. Now I'm freaked out because this piano player who's never played with me before is nailing this music.
Right.
Oh, this is too heavy for me. And I think the only reason I got in was because the following day I had an audition at the Manhattan School of Music with no accompanist this time. I got to play solo, they pretty much had the same bass faculty as Juilliard. So those same people heard me the next day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I was much looser, much calmer. And so I think that maybe influenced them getting me into Juilliard.
Oh, wow. So you pretty much auditioned for two schools.
That's about it.
In a row.
Because I was determined. I didn't want to go to Berkeley. I had a full four-year scholarship to go to Berkeley. And as crazy as it sounds, I had to turn it down. I said, I don't want to go to Boston, you know.
What did your parents say?
My mother, you know, she was like, well, you better damn well make sure wherever you go, it better not be much money coming out of our pockets. Yeah, I had another scholarship to Carnegie Mellon.
Oh, my goodness.
I said, man, I didn't even think they had a jazz program there or much of a music program.
Well, they didn't have a jazz program at Juilliard when you were there.
No, they didn't. But I knew that being in New York, you know, I was just going to go hang out at night. You know, that was going to be my jazz lessons, you know. And Central State in Ohio, I had a scholarship to go there.
Oh, okay.
But I said, no, I just want to go to New York. Got to go to New York. Either the new school, Manhattan School of Music, or Juilliard. Okay. I don't care which one it is, as long as I'm in New York. So I got my wish.
So you eventually left Juilliard because you were gigging.
I started gigging. Fortunately, started gigging pretty fast. And after I somehow made it through my first year, my first and only year, I called my mother. I said, Mom, I'm working a lot, and I just don't think that I'm going to get at Juilliard what I'm getting from all these great gigs I'm getting to do. So I don't think I'm going to go back to Juilliard. And I remember there was this long pause. And I just like, oh, my God, what's she going to tell me? And she says, well, where are you going to live? I said, well, my friend Mark Carey, who was playing with Betty Carter at that time, he says he has room in his apartment, so I'm going to go move in with Mark. And there was another long pause. She says, well, if you're your mother's child, I trust that you're going to make the right decision and you'll be fine.
Wow.
So I was like, wow, thanks, Bob, thank you. So that's how it all happened once I got out of Juilliard.
And you eventually wound up, well, let's see, you played with Bobby Watson.
Yes.
Yes.
Bobby Watson.
Was he your first?
My very, very first gig in New York.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to Juilliard for about a week and a half, something like that. And, you know, I'm still learning my instructors' names and learning the students, you know, my fellow students' names. And I go to class one day and some guy says, Mr. McBride, some man was in here looking for you. That's not really something you want to hear because that sounds a little too ambiguous. It's like some man is here looking for me. And, well, what did he look like? He said, he's a tall, skinny guy. And, you know, he just said he was looking for you. I'm thinking, oh, man. Was he a musician? Or, well, we don't know. We didn't ask. And, of course, Juilliard, particularly then, I'm sure it's the same way now. You needed ID to get in there. You just couldn't go in.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm wondering.
People,
great.
You know? So, like, well, how'd he get in here? So, for three classes, hey, Christian, some man was just in here. He was looking for you. I'm like, well, somebody tell me where he is. And who is he? Oh, we didn't get his name. Oh, man. So I went to lunch. And I see this guy sitting in the cafeteria with a newspaper. And somebody said, yeah, that's him right over there.
I was like,
it was Bobby Watson.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, phew. I was like, man, what's going on? He says, you working this weekend? I said, no. He said, well, you are now.
Oh.
So you're going to play with me at Birdland this weekend. And be me, you, James Williams, and Victor Lewis.
Wow, nice.
And I thought, boy, I was hoping I would get at least one warm-up gig with some of my peers in New York before I got called right to the big leagues. And it was traumatic.
Oh.
It was pretty traumatic. Bobby was yelling at me.
Oh, my goodness.
And I'm messing up the chord changes, and Bobby said I was dragging. And,
oh, no.
Thank God for James Williams, because he was such a gentle soul. You know, James, what am I doing wrong? You know, he said, oh, man, you'll be all right. Just keep doing what you're doing. Just keep your ears open. You'll be all right. And Bobby didn't fire me, though. He kept me in this band for, you know, two more years after that.
Wow.
So I loved working with Bobby.
Yeah.
It was very important to me.
So did you wind up working with Betty Carter after Bobby? Or
That's a long story.
Uh-oh.
I actually never played with Betty's band. That's actually that's a common misnomer. Because I was very close with Betty.
Uh-huh.
And I recorded with Betty.
Exactly. That's it. You recorded with her.
But I never toured with her.
Oh, I see.
But I'll tell you what happened was, again, this is where Mark Carey comes into the picture. Mm-hmm. I'm going to Juilliard, and school year's almost over. And at that time, Taurus Mateen was playing bass with her.
Okay.
And Taurus, you know, we used to hang tight also at that time. He says, hey, man, I think I'm going to give Betty notice. You know, I'm going to tell her she should hire you. I say, man, I'd be honored. You know, so Mark and, you know, everybody had it all lined up. Said, man, you know, we're going to make sure Betty knows about you. We're going to bring her out to hear you play. And I know she's going to love you. She's going to hire you. And Greg Hutchinson was the drummer.
Mm.
And he said, oh, man, this is going to be a trio. And Greg was like, man, me, you, and Mark, oh, man, this is going to be great. So Betty came to hear me play somewhere, and we got to be really good pals. And she says, so you want the gig? I was like, yes, Ms. Carter, I would love to be in your band. She said, okay, look, I'm going to Europe for 3 weeks, and when I get back, I'll be in touch, and, you know, we'll schedule all the rehearsals.
Mm-hmm.
So word is all around, you know, Christian's about to get the gig with Betty Carter.
Mm-hmm.
I call my mother. She's like, oh, congratulations, honey, that's great. And, you know, so after about 3 weeks, I don't hear anything.
Mm.
So I'm thinking, man, where is she? So I get this message one day from Mark. He left a message for me at the Y. He said, call me. It's urgent. So I called Mark back. I said, what's up? He says, man, why didn't you call Betty? I said, she said she was going to call me when she got back in town.
Right.
He said, well, I think some of y'all lines got crossed because she's getting ready to hire another bass player.
Oh.
You better call her now. It's like, oh, man. So I called Betty. She's not home. Like,
oh, no.
So I called Greg Hutchinson, and Greg's like, man, what's up, man? We thought you were going to get on the gig. I said, I thought so, too. He's like, man, Betty is like, you know, Christian never called me. I guess he doesn't want the gig. So I'm desperately calling Betty for like 2 days. And so I finally reach her on the phone, and I said, Miss Carter, it's Christian McBride. She said, where you been, baby? I said, I've been here in school. I've been waiting for you to call. No, you were supposed to call me. I said, but Miss Carter, you just said 3 weeks. You didn't say what day you were getting home. She said, well, honey, I'm sorry. I got some gigs coming up, and I wouldn't hire another bass player. A big stake went right in my heart. Like, oh, God. So she wound up hiring Dwayne Bruno.
Oh, okay.
And this was right before she made that live album called Dropping Things.
Yes.
Live at the Bottom Line.
Wow.
And so that was, I think, Taurus's last gig, and that was to be the gig that Dwayne, originally me, was supposed to go watch so we could learn the book.
I see.
So I spoke to Betty's manager, Ora Harris, and I said, Ora, I wanted to get it. You know, and she's like, well, baby, I don't know what to tell you. She said, the best thing I can tell you is come by rehearsal, just hang at rehearsal, and I see what happens, you know. So I go to rehearsal, and Dwayne is looking at me like, what you doing here? You ain't supposed to be here. He didn't say that, but his eyes did, you know. And so I'm just sitting there like, you know, please, Betty, change your mind.
Mm.
But she didn't. Mm. Dwayne stayed on the band, I think, for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
But it worked out great because I was still gigging with Bobby, but I also wound up playing with Freddie.
Yes, yes. Well, before we get to Freddie, you did record with Betty.
Yes.
You recorded on...
the album's called It's Not About the Melody.
Yes. Yeah. Sleepy Time Down South.
Yes.
Yes.
That's right.
Pale moon shining on the fields below. Folks are crooning songs, soft and low. Needn't tell me so, because I know when it's sleepy time down south. Soft winds blowing through the pinewood trees. Folks down there live a life of ease when the twilight Joe's dream, the folks all sing. They dance till the break of day. Thank you.
I remember vividly being in the studio. So I remember I played the solo, and we're in the studio. Now, it's nervous enough being in the studio with Betty. I mean, I was honored to be there because by that time I knew her well, but, you know, we never had a chance to make much music together. So I'm in the studio with her. Mogra Miller and Lewis Nash are there. And she says, okay, Christian, I want you to play something. So I played this bass solo. She says, stop. That's too regular. Oh. Play something else. I was like, okay. I play something else. She's like, no. She's like, I want you to lose me. You know, I want to be able to listen to you and not really know what you're doing.
Wow.
I was like, all right. So I played like this most abstract, you know, well, to me, it was abstract and a little off center. And she's like, yeah, that's what I want.
Well, I was saying, you definitely held your own. It's like, oh my gosh. So how old were you when you did this?
I think we did that in 94. 93, 94, so 21, 22, something like that.
You were just of drinking age.
Yeah, right. But I miss Betty so much, though, because Betty was, she made it a point to get out all the time and hear what the young cats were doing. You know, she was in Bradley's every night, at the Village Gate every night, at Birdland every night, the Blue Note every night. Wherever it was, she was just always scoping out what cats were doing. I remember one night she piled about 8 guys into a car. Me, Chris Thomas, Ben Wolf, Mark Carey, Greg Hutchinson, just making the rounds with Mama Betty driving.
Sunday, December 11th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl will feature bassist, composer, and band leader Christian McBride. Recently, Christian's latest recording, The Good Feeling, was nominated for a Grammy. That's Sunday, December 11th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. So, Freddie.
Yeah. Well, that's a good lead-in because, if you remember, Freddie is a guest star on that Dropping Things album with Betty Carter.
Yes, yes.
So, and that was the other reason I was so disappointed, because I was going to get to play with Freddie and Betty Carter on that gig had I gotten it.
Right.
So I hadn't met Freddie yet at that point. This was May of 1990, and just fate is something. I'm all disappointed because I'm not going to get to play with Freddie or Betty. About 2 weeks later, after that gig, Carr Allen calls and says, hey, man, I got a gig for you in Columbia, South Carolina, and we're going to play behind Freddie. I was like, what? Ooh! It was something called the Budweiser Jazz Explosion. Remember that? And so we were the house rhythm section. We had to play behind Noel Pointer, Gene Karn, and Lonnie Liston-Smith and Freddie.
Wow.
And so I got to play with Freddie, and I didn't think I made much of an impression on Freddie that night. You know, we didn't really rehearse. He just kind of came up and just called a couple of tunes. But to play with him, just, you know, at that time, his chops were still on fire. And that was in May, and 3 months later, Carl calls me again. He says, okay, Freddie needs a bass player for this next gig in Chicago. So I flew to Chicago and played this gig with Freddie. And I stayed in this band for 2.5 years.
Wow.
And I enjoyed every single moment of it.
Yeah, I understood you weren't sure that he was even listening to you.
Oh, man, he just no acknowledgement whatsoever. I mean, none. I mean, at least on my first gig with Bobby, he was yelling at me, you know. You know, Bobby's like, no, man, no, that's not right. That's not right. But Freddie was just, you know, nothing. They solo star, he leaves.
Oh, no.
He goes on the side of the stage, light up a cigarette, start holding conversation. Finally, the guy he's talking to is like, hey, Freddie, I think your bass player's finished. Okay. And then after the gig was over, he just made this announcement. He was like, yeah, you know, this 18-year-old kid, he's bad. You know, he's in the band now.
Wow.
Boy, he had me that whole gig. Wow. Boy, I felt so awful.
He was amazing, though.
Yes,
he was absolutely just.
Yes, he was.
And, yeah, I'm going to have to play something from Live at Fat Tuesdays.
Dude, yes.
Actually, you wrote something.
Well, we're going to dedicate all this music that we're going to record this evening to the late, great Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers.
Like this book with you or something?
I wish I could have that back. Well, see, that's part of that Art Blakey lineage because Freddie demanded that we all bring in a tune.
Yeah.
Says, look, you know, we got this week coming up in Fat Tuesdays. We're going to record on the weekend. I want each of you guys to bring in some new music. So Javon Jackson brought in the tune, which sadly didn't get on the CD.
Right.
But Betty brought in one. I brought in one. And my song, EGAD, which I wound up re-recording on Number 2 Express, my second CD, it was still kind of unfinished, you know. Certain melody notes didn't go with the chords quite right yet, and I wasn't quite sure of the form and things like that, and but Freddie was just like, it's all right, we'll figure it out.
So was EGAD the scale, or was it
that's the
your
open
exclamation
on the bass?
Okay.
Scramble. The open strings on the bass are actually EADG.
Right.
So let me just switch two strings and it'd be EGAD. I remember Freddie, and you know, he asked me the same question.
Mm-hmm.
What is EGAD?
Well, I thought it had
what,
some.
What, Scotland Yard detective or something?
Well, I thought it had something to do with, you know, the bass
See?
And playing. But then I also thought you were exclaiming, you know, having to be
right.
out there.
Well, that too. It's got all kinds of subliminal meaning.
Getting to it. You were on Verve, right?
Yes.
How did you get that deal?
94. Mm-hmm. Warner Brothers had just started the jazz division. They had signed Joshua Redman. They had signed Kenny Garrett. Mm-hmm. They had signed David Sanborn, Mark wow. Whitfield, and they were pushing up on Pat Metheny hard. Mm-hmm. So they were really, really trying to get their jazz division established. And so they were on me. And I said, man, you know, we really think you have something to contribute. You know, we'd like you to come on Warner Brothers. You know, it was part of that whole Young Lions era. Yeah. All the cats were getting major deals. And I didn't want to do it because I said, you know, maybe I might be ready to record my own CD, but I don't want to feel like I'm jumping on the Young Lion bandwagon. Mm-hmm. So let me hold off for a little while and keep doing these sideman gigs. Mm-hmm. But in retrospect, I probably shouldn't have had to worry about that because, you know, like Hargrove and I, and well, particularly Hargrove and myself, I mean, we made it a point of always trying to stay around the elders, mm-hmm. you know. Our MO was not to just get a record deal and mm-hmm. just kind of try to show out as band leaders. We wanted to learn. Right. We wanted to get our butts kicked.
Right.
I said, well, let me hold off a little while. But Warner Brothers was like, no, sign. Mm. I don't want to. No, come on, you got to sign with us. Like, I don't want to. Uh-huh. You know? So I gave in. Mm-hmm. They're like, okay, awesome, man, all right, whatever. Mm-hmm. So this was the beginning of 94, and I said, well, I haven't signed the contract officially, but I'll give you my word. Okay, great.
Hmm. Interesting.
And then Richard Seidel, who was at Verve Records at that time, the Verve was the only label that we hadn't heard from. So my manager at the time, we were like, man, what's up with Verve? I don't guess they ain't interested, you know. So Richard Seidel calls and he says, yeah, I'm just calling to congratulate you. I heard you guys signed with Warner Brothers. And my manager says, well, we haven't yet signed with Warner Brothers. Said, you haven't?
Mm.
Said, no. Said, well, you know, word is around the street that you guys signed with Warner Brothers. Said, well, we gave him our word, but we haven't signed yet. He said, you mind taking a meeting with us?
Oh, wow.
So we went up to Verve, and the vibe was what I was looking for mm-hmm. because they had a great balance of the young cats and the older masters. They had Joe Henderson. They mm-hmm. had Abby Lincoln. They mm-hmm. had Betty. And I said, I think this is where I want to be.
Yeah.
And stay with Verve for six years and four CDs.
Okay.
Yep.
And you recorded with Abby Lincoln and
yes.
Joe Henderson. And
yep.
And Betty Carter. We haven't even gotten a chance to talk about your two new CDs.
I know, right? Well, we kind of sort of
yeah,
talked about the conversation.
The Big Band CD.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Good Feeling.
Good Feeling.
Thank you.
good feeling. And that's apparently that was your dream.
Yeah. Yeah.
One
of my many dreams. Why a big band? Because I've always been fascinated with orchestration and people who can write for more than three horns. Mm. You know, I think the first recording that I ever heard that really captured my imagination. I mean, you know, of course, listen to Ellington and Basie and all the classic stuff, but I think it was Oliver Nelson's Blues and the Abstract Truth.
Yes, yes. With Freddie,
you know.
And Eric Dolphy.
That's right. Paul Chambers, yes. Roy Haynes, yes. Bill Evans. And I'm listening to this going, you know, listen to these voicings, you know, the way one horn's going up and one horn's going down, and some guys are unison and some guys are a minor second away. And I said, hey, man, this is fascinating. Mm-hmm. It could sound like a big band with only four or five horns. Mm-hmm. I said, man, I want to learn how to do that. So I started like trying to copy each part from each song on Blues and the Abstract Truth. And then there was a McCoy Tyner album called Tender Moments.
Oh, okay.
Which I think is kind of roughly the same thing, like five horns or something like that. So same thing. I'm trying to figure out these voicings and why does that horn get that note instead of that horn? You know, let me see how this works out. So I just got fascinated with, ensemble writing. Mm-hmm. And then, I started listening to Thad Jones and Mel Lewis mm-hmm. and, Oliver Nelson's big band recordings mm-hmm. and, all the great CTI albums that Don Sebesky had arranged, like First Light
yes.
for Freddie.
Yes.
And, I just got big time into it. And, out of the blue, I get this call from Wynton Marsalis saying, I want you to write something for the big band.
Wow.
I said, wait a minute, man. I'm just scoping it out. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'm ready to write for big band. He's like, you'll figure it out. It's like, oh man. So again, I got thrown into the pit. Right away.
Yeah.
That's the best way to learn, though.
I was going to ask you about that. Let's finish up this discussion about the good feeling.
Okay.
Because I want to make sure that we talk about it.
Yeah. So anyway, 15 years of, you know, quietly writing for big band and trying to get it together and trial and error and, you know, talking the ears off of anybody who I respected as an arranger, from John Clayton to Bob Brookmeyer, Jerry Dodgen, Maria Schneider, mm-hmm. Billy Childs, mm-hmm. All of them. I just said, you know, how do you do this? Jimmy Heath, Benny mm-hmm. Golson.
Yeah.
So how do you do this? You know, I said, well, you can do this or you can do that. And I said, oh, man, I got to shed on this. So a year and a half ago, I finally got into the studio to record my own arrangements and orchestrations. And I was very happy with how it turned out.
Well, you did a reworking of a song that you did on Kind of Brown, Brother Mister.
Yeah.
That is really nice. I like both of them. I mean, I like the one from Kind of Brown.
Yeah.
With the smoker.
Right. Yeah. Thank you.
Should probably say something. I haven't said anything. This is Sugar in My Bowl on WBAI New York 99.5 FM, and you are indeed listening to a conversation between myself, Joyce Jones, and Christian McBride. There was so much for him to talk about, so little time for me to play stuff, because everything he said was just a jewel. That's why he must return. But let me tell you, right now you're listening to Brother Mister, the version from Kind of Brown. As Krista McBride mentioned at the top of the program, that everyone had to pay attention, yeah, that was a warning. That's how you get to find out what you're listening to. Kind of Brown was released on Mac Avenue Records in 2009. It's Christian McBride on bass, Victor Lewis on drums, Eric Scott Reed on piano, Steve Wilson on sax, whom I'm speaking of right now, Warren Wolf Jr. on vibes, and that's Christian McBride with Inside Straight, who were playing at the Village Vanguard on the evening that I was chatting with him. And in our WBAI studios, he had to rush and get out of here and go play, which fortunately I was able to enjoy. But before that, we heard the version of Brother Mister, which was written by Christian McBride, from the Christian McBride Big Band, The Good Feeling, also released on Mac Avenue Records this year. The Good Feeling, newly nominated for a Grammy. It was like the week after we stopped talking, or a couple of days, I guess, after we finished our exchange, I found out about the nomination, which was yay. Congratulations there. Before that, we heard In a Hurry, which I am right now. In a Hurry was written by Christian McBride. It was from Christian McBride's Verve release, his debut release as a... as an artist, not as a sideman, actually. This is from Getting Into It. Christian McBride on bass, Roy Hargrove on trumpet, Joshua Redman on tenor sax, Steve Teray on trombone, Cyrus Chestnut on piano, Lewis Nash on drums. Oh, I better hurry. Before that, we heard Freddie Hubbard, EGAD, which was written by Christian McBride, Live at Fat Tuesdays on the Music Masters Records, a 1992 release. Freddie Hubbard on trumpet, Christian McBride on bass, Benny Green on piano, Javon Jackson on tenor sax, and Tony Redis on drums. And at this point, I'd like to say, hey, Janice Grice. Okay. Before that, we heard When It's Sleepy Time Down South, Betty Carter. It's Not About the Melody, 1992 Verve release. Betty Carter vocals, Christian McBride bass, Mogul Miller piano, Lewis Nash on drums, and I need to stop because we're going back to the exchange. Stay tuned for more Sugar in My Bowl and the exchange with Christian McBride.
Well, I just hope that, financially it's so difficult to actually tour with a big band. It's pretty much close to impossible.
Right.
But I certainly think that we will be playing in New York quite a bit next year. Mm-hmm. It will at least do a week in the club somewhere.
Wow. And Conversations with Christian.
Yep.
How did
Which came out 5 weeks after The Good Feeling.
Yeah. Gosh.
Double CD drop for me.
Right.
Turning into Prince.
How did you decide who you'd have the conversations with?
Well, I'll give you a practical answer. A lot of it depended on schedule.
Yeah.
That's why it took so long to make it.
Mm.
I just made a wish list of all of the people who, well, for starters, I think one thing that's different from my duet CD as opposed to maybe some other duet projects is I actually know everyone who I recorded with, and I'd worked with them all before.
Did you do them all in the studio?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Some in New York, some in L.A., and one in Chicago.
But you were in the same room.
Oh, yeah. We were there together live, and I made this wish list of all of these people who I wanted to record with, and I'm very happy I had Hank Jones and Dr. Billy Taylor on that list.
Yes.
they wouldn't be here to see the release. Mm-hmm. You know, two of the classiest, most elegant, and great musicians of our time. I'm very happy to have recorded with them, not only on my CD, but I had a chance to record with them both on CDs of theirs and do various gigs with them. And just, I feel really honored to have been around such great legends.
Yeah, I'm really going to have difficulty trying to figure out what to play from these because I am digging so much.
Well, whatever you play, I'll be appreciative.
They're excellent recordings, both of them. Was it your idea to come out with them so closely, or?
Not particularly. Actually, they both were supposed to come out earlier in the year. Mm. Simultaneously.
Okay.
But, you know, like I said, the scheduling, just, and plus dealing with all of those different artists, you have 13 different estates and record labels and lawyers to deal with. So, you know, some people were faster than others. And,
I see.
And particularly, you know, somebody like Sting, who was the beautiful person, guy I loved working with all these years. But, you know, we had to get clearance from his record label. Clearance from his management, clearance from this, clearance from that.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, doggone.
Thank you.
Now, there's one person who we really didn't spend too much time talking about, but he definitely left an impression in your life.
Mm.
Ray Brown.
Yes, Ray Brown. I miss him dearly. It's amazing. I heard someone say, I think it was Jeff Keyser, he was talking about, someone asked him about playing with Art Blakey.
Mm-hmm.
And he made a comment that seems to be really true. He said, all those guys from that generation, like the bebop generation guys, they were very cut and dry mm-hmm. about what it was all about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, them guys were hard, you know, hard living,
mm-hmm.
Hard swinging.
Mm-hmm.
Everything about them was just, you know, and Ray Brown was like that. Although he was a very sweet and sophisticated man, his whole thing was when you swing, you better swing hard.
Mm-hmm.
Get the full sound out of the bass. And his phrase was, keep your foot in their neck. I mean, I would work, play with Ray Brown sometimes and or watch him play. He'd just be, go, go,
wow.
Go, go. It was like, golly. And I used to think, well, that must be pretty heavy for a drummer to play with somebody that strong. Now, the irony is that there are a lot of drummers who didn't like playing with Ray Brown.
Mm.
I used to think, well, how could you be a drummer and not enjoy playing with that?
Uh-huh.
And they said, because it's too strong. Drums are superfluous for Ray Brown.
Well,
I said, well, you know, I kind of get that.
Mm.
You know? They said, man, Ray would come in just so powerful and strong.
Mm-hmm.
Most drummers felt like, oh, well, I guess I don't really need to be here now, do I? So I kind of dug where they were coming from on that, but I'm really glad I got a chance to be around Ray, who to me was just as important as Art Blakey and mm-hmm. Betty Carter when it came to like nurturing all the young cats.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people did that. You know, Abby did that.
Mm-hmm.
Freddie did that.
Yeah.
You know, maybe to a lesser extent because, you know, Art Blakey and Betty and Ray Brown's, their M.O. was, you know, I just want young cats.
Right,
you
right.
Know, cause they got the fire, they got the energy, they ain't all jaded.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't know it all, you know. Milt Jackson, I remember Milt Jackson, boy, he was another guy that didn't pull no punches. Mm. Milt was just like, man, I'm sick of these old cats. I said, what you talking about, Milt? You said, man, these guys, you know, all these old cats with these temperaments and all that stuff, man. I just give me some young cats, man.
Harold Maber.
Ooh, Mabes. Oh, gosh, it was strong. Mm. Strong. You know, Mayburn, first of all, he's a walking encyclopedia of every Tin Pan Alley American songbook standard you could ever met. Mm. The most obscure Broadway songs and all that stuff. I mean, he knows all that stuff. And he just gets such a big, full sound out of the piano. He's another one of those musicians, I think, that, you know, when he hits hard. You know what I mean? And a beautiful man to be around, too. So funny. So funny.
One last thing I want to ask you, because you need to get out of here.
Yes.
What do you think the importance between gigging and the institution?
Well, the institution is only as good as what you do inside as it relates to gigging, you know. Just because you might succeed in the institution, unfortunately, that means nothing, you know. The end game is to be out gigging and knowing that everything you learned in the institution might not work. Now it's up to your own devices and musicality to make it work. You know, I think sometimes there are a lot of musicians who they go to these schools and they're the best musician in their school. Mm-hmm. And then that sticks with them, and they go outside of the institution. They wonder why they can't get any gigs. It's like, nobody cares you're the best piano player or drummer or bass player in your school. Mm-hmm. You know, this is school out here, right. You know. And just because your teachers or your fellow students might tell you how wonderful you are, that all that means nothing mm-hmm. out here in gigging. So to me, the institution only gives you a safe haven to, it's like training ground to, mm-hmm. to come out and get your butt kicked, you know. Right. And I think as long as these young musicians know that, mm-hmm. they'll succeed. You know, because they just want to be the best. Some of these guys are satisfied with being the best in school. Mm-hmm. And that, man, that's way too easy.
Yeah.
You know, they say, well, man, we can't get any gigs. I said, that's not true. There's plenty of gigs out here with a lot of people. They might not be people who you know mm-hmm. or who might be on your list, but they're people who you can learn from right. all over the place. Right. That's why I'm always telling these young cats, I said, gig with everybody, you know. Just don't get into your whole little box like, okay, well, I play like this, so I want to play with a band that plays like that. Mm-hmm. You got to play with everybody.
Do you think the opportunities are still there to play with
everybody? I do.
Okay.
I know there's that argument that, you know, a lot of the grandmasters are gone. Mm-hmm. You know, young
and
cats,
the clubs are closing.
Yeah. But as you know, that always happens. Mm-hmm. You know, clubs are cyclical. You know, every club that closes, there's a new one that opens, and it's just, particularly in New York, mm-hmm. you know, I don't think there'll ever be a shortage of places to play here in New York. I mean, you might not get paid that well, mm-hmm. but you'll definitely have a place to hone your skills. Mm-hmm. But in terms of, like, the apprenticeship thing going on, you know, the argument is that, well, these young cats today won't get a chance to be around Betty Carter, and they won't have a chance to be around Art Blakey and Abby Lincoln and Freddie Hubbard and Ray Brown. But they do get a chance to be around somebody like a Kenny Barron
right.
or a McCoy Tyner,
right.
you know, or a Terrence Blanchard. I mean, they are new giants
right.
on the scene.
Or Roy Hargrove.
Hello. You know, I right. mean, if I were 18, 19 years old in college, I would be looking up to Roy Hargrove as one of the giants, mm-hmm. you know. Just because he wasn't born in the 40s and 50s doesn't mean he can't school me.
Right,
you know.
Right.
So I think there are a lot of opportunities for young kids.
Or Christian McBride.
Oh, thank you. I'm a mean band leader, though. Nobody wants to play with me. Nah, I'm joking. I'm like Ray Brown. Come on, put your foot in his neck. Stop all that beating around the bush. Get to it.
And this is my very last question.
Okay. It's really got to be.
It is, most definitely.
Not because I don't want to.
No, because you need
you.
To go.
Yeah.
No, and I wish you could. And you should come back sometime.
Anytime.
Playing with Pat Metheny.
Yes.
How'd you wind up doing that, and would you do it again?
He, I don't think I realized this, but Pat told me, he says, well, I first heard you in Freddie's band, mm-hmm. right after you joined Freddie's band.
Wow.
We played in Boston at the Regatta Bar where Pat was living at that time. And he said, man, you know, I'd heard about this 18-year-old kid playing bass with Freddie, and I came and saw you. And he said, I remember you playing electric. I said, oh, yeah. Freddie would have me play that on Red Clay and First Light, you know. So the first time I played with Pat was when Pat put together a group with myself, Joshua Redman, and Billy Higgins. That was in 1993. And Pat is such an incredible musician, and he has an incredible mind. I love speaking with him on a lot of different things. For a while, after that 93 tour, we only kind of played together sporadically, but then in 2003, I think it was 2003, he started that trio with myself and Antonio Sanchez.
Right, right.
And we played together. Yeah, there
day trip, yes.
We played together roughly for 5 years with that trio. And we played together again for the first time earlier this year. Pat did a guitar camp in Norwich, Connecticut, and he got the trio back together for that. So we were together for a weekend. I'm sure we'll be playing together again real soon. Pat is somebody I really respect a whole lot.
Well, thank you, Christian McBride. We really respect you here.
Oh, thank you. I love talking with you and hanging with you, and promise we'll do part two very soon.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Well, that was a conversation with Christian McBride. This is Sugar and My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones. I need to get out of here. La Nueva Alternativa is coming up next. For those whom I slighted by not mentioning the artists and the songs and all that other stuff, the playlist is available. There is no waiting. Well, as soon as my partner Hank puts it up on the sugarinmybowl.org website, it will be there. And from what I understand, it will be up before he goes to sleep. So, which hopefully will be soon. Anyway, stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa. The folks are here, and I'm going to get out. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. See you next year.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.